and welcome to The Swiss Connection. I'm Susan Masika. Every 4 years, the Red Cross movement gathers in Geneva for its General Assembly, a meeting that brings together every national Red Cross or Red Crescent Society, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and government ministers. They typically discuss aid policy, along with the challenges and risks of humanitarian work. At the latest assembly, they talked about how to remain neutral and impartial in the face of anti-terror laws. Aid agencies say that these well-intentioned policies could seriously limit their humanitarian work. For this episode of our Inside Geneva series, correspondent Imogen Folks delved deeper into this tricky topic, along with Tristan Ferrero of the ICRC, Duncan McLean of Doctors Without Borders, and Daniel Warner of the Graduate Institute.
Welcome to Inside Geneva. We're recording this month's edition in the week when the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Red Cross Federation have been holding their General Assembly. It only takes place once every 4 years. It's a really very important venue to talk about the issues and challenges for humanitarians and the work they do. Now, some of the things that have been discussed have been integrity and shrinking space and counterterrorism legislation. What I want to do first, because we always hear a little something before we start talking, is play you the ideal of what humanitarian work is. This is from a video produced by the Red Cross Federation this year.
Serving those in need all over the world, the most vulnerable people, the hardest to reach.
Protection and restoring the dignity of people all over the world.
We are there before, during, and after crisis. We are part of the communities we serve.
We walk the last mile. We are everywhere for everyone.
Everywhere for everybody. Is that the case with humanitarian work in the 21st century? And if not, why not? What's hindering it? We're going to focus specifically on that issue of counterterrorism legislation. I'm joined by Tristan Ferrero, who is Senior Legal Officer with the International Committee of the Red Cross, and Duncan McLean, who is a researcher with Médecins Sans Frontières. Some of you may know that better as Doctors Without Borders. And of course, Daniel Warner, our devil's advocate, historical perspective analyst in chief. Tristan and Duncan, I'm going to start with you first, Tristan. You've both worked in the field, in conflict zones, in situations that some of our listeners may be shocked that you ever got involved in the first place. Tell me about one of them, Tristan.
I think one of them, which is an important one for me because it was my first mission abroad for the ICRC, was when I was deployed in 2002 in Afghanistan, covering central region of Afghanistan, in which we had to reach out very important situation where the population was really suffering. And some of the parts in which I was operating were under the responsibility, the control of the armed opposition, in particular under the control of groups that have been designated as terrorists. And I would say this is one of my most important and most marking situation in which I have been deployed in.
Duncan?
Yeah, there's a fair few contexts that required negotiations with those that certainly today will be referred to as terrorists. I was struck by a fairly lengthy stay in Nepal in the mid-2000s that essentially involved negotiating with what the government perceived as terrorists, the Maoist movement in the hinterland, but simultaneously negotiating, of course, with the authorities to basically obtain a parallel access and literally moving back and forth between the front lines. And I'm struck by that because at least in that particular context, it was certainly not an easy task, but we were eventually able to obtain that access. And I'm not sure in the context of 2019 whether I'd be able to say the same thing.
Explain to our listeners, because some already will be thinking it's the army's job or it's the government's job to get hold of these groups and either defeat them or imprison them, and that something like the Red Cross or MSF really has no business getting involved. And now I know this is basic here in Geneva, but some people don't understand that.
Yeah, I think our role is mainly, as you know, to reach out population that needs as a result of armed conflict. And in order to reach out this population, we need to talk to everybody, to all the belligerents involved, irrespective of their designation, irrespective of their label, and irrespective of what they do in the field, even if they commit violation of international humanitarian law or world, in order to access the area in which we want to operate, in order just to fulfill the needs of the population. We need to discuss with these individuals. And our role is only aim at fulfilling this mandate, and if this mandate requires to engage with stakeholders, with belligerents, which sometimes have been labeled and as terrorists, and engage in the worst act possible. But this is our role to do so, to reach out our population.
You know, humanitarianism comes from the word human, and you're still dealing with people. But my real point is, when you talk about groups, terrorist groups, in fact, they're the problem or part of the problem, but they're also part of the solution. So whereas you think you can defeat them or make believe that they're going to go away, you have to negotiate with them in order to have some kind of solution, either politically or just for people, civilians who are suffering.
So on the political side, it's in a sense it's an easy opt-out, but obviously as a humanitarian organization with the basic principles of impartiality, neutrality, independence, and so on, to engage them in terms of a political solution is not really our job, but certainly to engage with them to be able to access those areas where there are people that would need the type of care that we can offer for the security of our own teams. This is absolutely necessary. And if we don't have that, it essentially cuts off significant chunks of a population that we simply cannot provide any support.
I mean, one of the arguments against talking to these groups is that you give them legitimacy. In other words, they become a quasi-governmental organization. But as you said, isn't it necessary to talk to them to help the civilian populations?
Yeah, it's not only necessary to help to talk to them, to help the civilian population. What is also very important is to be able to reach out to these individuals and to go into the area in which they operate, also to ensure the security of our staff, because we will not able to deliver our humanitarian activities if we are not able also to ensure the security of our staff. These are two faces of the same coin, and that's once again the reason for which we need to talk to this group. Once again, irrespective of their label and irrespective of the cause that they are exposing, really, because for us it's really in the political realm, and we are not interested in being engaged in these political debates.
I would also argue that this point about giving legitimacy to armed groups, terrorists, and otherwise, this is something that's been repeated again and again and again in history. And if we look back at the Geneva Conventions pre 1949 and also 1949 and the additional protocols, I mean they've been extended to situations of civil war, of domestic armed conflict, for a reason. And of course, this is always going to include in the context of conflict armed groups that are somehow looking for legitimacy. I'm not sure that humanitarians that are, in a case of MSF, that are providing medical care are going to change the scope and shape of the conflict. That's going to come from elsewhere.
Tristan, you were
just to bounce on what just can say. What is also important to underline that to engage with this group designated as terrorists is not only necessary for us, but it's a task, a mandate that has been assigned to us by state under the Geneva Convention. So it's not something that we have decided to do by ourselves. It's also something that has been accepted by state for us to do in order to deliver our mandate. And just without going into legal arguments, but there is a very important provision under international humanitarian law, which is Common Article 3 covering non-international armed conflict, which clearly specifies that the applicability of IHL and the humanitarian activities delivered by impartial humanitarian organizations just like us does not confer any kind of legitimacy with the non-state armed groups we are engaging with.
One of the things, though, about counterterrorism legislation is it's not really just that you talk to people who others might class as terrorists. Some would say when you go in and you're delivering medical supplies, when you are delivering food, when you are treating people, that you are, to use a not very kind phrase, aiding and abetting. And that does lie behind some of this legislation.
Certainly not all countries are pleased that you talk to some of these groups or individuals, and you run risks not only for your personal safety, but also you can be arrested in certain countries if you talk to certain groups who are labeled terrorists. How do you get around that problem?
First of all, I think to be very clear, there is only a very few states that are criminalizing the simple fact to talk to non-state armed groups. In the vast majority of the counterterrorism legislation, what is prohibited and punished under those laws is the support to this group.
Material support,
which is very often interpreted in a very broad way that could encompass basic activities we have been assigned to under the Geneva Convention. And when I say we, I think also it's not only the HRC, but also any organization that is acting according to the principle of humanitarian action.
So I think, and I'm pretty certain that it goes far beyond ICRC and MSF. I think we're quite aware of our responsibility in terms of the misuse of the aid that we provide. And again, we're speaking about the specific context of counterterrorism, but it's a responsibility that we have to our donors, to our colleagues, staff, and patients themselves. But to come back to your specific point, in a clinic, in a hospital, you see a patient. You don't see a patient that belongs to organization group X, Y, or Z. It's a patient. And that is very clearly defined under international humanitarian law.
But also, you basically operate like any doctor is supposed to. You see the patient, not their background.
I don't think it's reasonable to expect the medical staff to make that distinction, and that's not just referring to sort of legal provisions in terms of the law of war, but basic medical ethics as well that our staff have to subscribe to.
But do you think you're winning this debate with governments and the general public?
I think we are trying actually to do our utmost in order to familiarize, the public, but also the governments to our argument, in particular, the necessity for us to operate in accordance to the mandate that have been assigned to us. And I think one of our role is, first of all, and that's what we do, in particular, in a bit more vocal way in the last 2 years, simply because we have been more and more, we as IHRC, more and more affected by this criminal legislation that have been drafted for counterterrorism purposes. And what we are just, first of all, just trying to make the government and the population understand is, first of all, the effect of this counterterrorism legislation on our operation. Because the very first thing that we need to win in this discussion is to make sure that states and stakeholders understand that the counterterrorism legislation they have drafted mostly not for just putting the humanitarian in a difficult situation. That's really the reality. Very often, the impact on our humanitarian operation are side effects, adverse effects, but are not a primary objective of criminal legislation.
Dan, you're waiting patiently over
there. No, because I just was wondering, you go someplace where there's a conflict to do what you do. Do you get the government's permission from that country? Or could you ever go into a situation or stay there where the government doesn't want you to be there?
So I think this is an interesting point that the ICRC and MSF have not always taken the same. We've differed on this point. So we talk about working in an area of conflict. In pure finite terms, you're under the sovereignty of the state. But we know very well in practice, parts of that territory will be, because of the conflict itself, will be controlled by other groups. So our preference is to negotiate with all sides. But I can say very bluntly, we're not always successful. And we have refused access by the state concerned. And so we find other forms of accessing populations that are in distress, which essentially is the basis of sans frontierisme, the cross-border operations. And certainly an obvious example more recently is in Syria. But it's certainly not only MSF that is doing that, and not only non-governmental organizations. This is something that the UN has authorized as well.
After a long hesitation.
Yeah, I think we could do another podcast on that specific topic. But the point being is that we have a preference of how we would obtain access. But if we cannot, we are willing to consider other options.
We are a bit more nuanced approach, but I think for us, first of all, we prefer to have the consent of all the belligerents involved in the armed conflict. But we are operating also under the framework of international humanitarian law, and as you know, the IHRC is a guardian of international humanitarian law, and our interpretation mission of international humanitarian law is to say when we want to operate in a territory, we need to have, legally speaking, the consent of the territorial authority, but also as a matter of policy and for operational and practical reasons, we need also to operate with the consent of the non-state armed groups in which we would like to operate. But legally speaking, we think that we are obliged to seek and obtain the consent of the territorial authorities, meaning the effective government in place.
Let's have a look at one specific proposed legislation which a few countries have been having a look at, and that is to make it a criminal offence for one of their citizens to go to a designated terrorist area. So maybe we could talk northeast Syria at the moment, for example. And now, to a lot of people, that looks very sensible because it's trying to, these governments say, prevent their citizens becoming foreign fighters. Britain's looked at this. Holland is looking at it. Do you see pitfalls there for humanitarian workers?
In my answer, it's not questioning the security prerogatives of the state. That's actually not our business. But very clearly, without some type of exemption for humanitarian activities, very much as we've been describing, yes, that is absolutely a pitfall because on top of the challenges of negotiating access with those parties that control the territory, so again, terrorist groups as in the context of the discussion today, we're also being criminalized by the states from outside the territory itself. So of course, yeah, there's a very obvious pitfall and creating a situation that is, again, more difficult than it already is today.
I think on all sides, just in a similar way, the IHRC has never challenged the necessity and the legitimacy of states to take measures to ensure their security, and this can take the form of counterterrorism legislation. But what we need also to counter is also the unintended effect of this counterterrorism legislation. And for this specific law, so-called designated area, where it's prohibited for an individual to go in an area that has been designated as prohibited by a government, we see that without any humanitarian carve-outs within this legislation, there is a risk of humanitarian workers being criminalized for the simple fact to be present in the area that has been designated. And in order to avoid the adverse effect of such legislation, we at the IHRC, but we are not the only one, and we are coordinating our efforts with a lot of humanitarian organizations, we try to persuade governments and parliaments to make sure that in such legislation, which once again is legitimate, there is some what we call well-framed humanitarian exemption that would allow humanitarian workers operating according to the principle governing humanitarian action to be able to carry out their activities in these areas.
But in the United States, it is illegal to give material support to a terrorist organization or a potential terrorist organization. How does one define material support?
Normally, this should be defined by the legislation concerned in accordance with the international obligation binding the states taking this kind of material supports. And we are engaged with many states actually to make sure that this kind of legislation that are more and more implemented at domestic level by states because of Security Council resolution, by the way, needs to make sure that when they are developing this kind of legislation, they also take into account and act in conformity of their obligation under international humanitarian law. And under international humanitarian law, there is an obligation to allow and facilitate humanitarian action.
And we can also, the risk of overgeneralizing, speak specifically about what does material support actually imply, because it's generally kept very, very vague. And so, of course, states, which is understandable, leave it at their own discretion to enforce it. And that again, is problematic as well. When you have very vague terminology, what actually falls under material support? Is it running a hospital in territory that's controlled by whatever armed group, terrorist group that we're speaking about? I mean, is that what we're considering terrorist material support to terrorism?
Also, who's a terrorist? I mean, sorry, I'm a journalist. I ask these questions. But you are operating in a system where it's the government who decides what material support is and the government who decides who a terrorist is. And you're on the ground in conflict zones trying to be humanitarians.
That gets to a bit of the crux of an old but still quite pertinent debate today. It's sort of the right or wrong of a conflict and how you label the participants. I mean, that's absolutely not our job. I mean, we're operating in the reality and the consequences of those labels. But who today that's labeled terrorist 30 years ago, seditious rebels. That's what we are dealing with in practical terms.
Let's come back specifically to this counterterrorism issue before we wind up, because we're getting close to the end of our time. What I want to ask you both is it actually stopping you doing things? Maybe not the law itself, but the fear of the consequences of the new legislation, or decreasing funds? Are donors doing a bit, that seems a bit dodgy to me, I'd rather invest in something nice and some nice, cheerful, peaceful place that maybe doesn't need the money as much, but I'll be safe if I invest in that?
You're right. And I would say that's why the IHRC for the last 2 years, we have decided to engage stakeholders to be more vocal in the public audience, because we have felt the constraint of counterterrorism legislation, but not only counterterrorism legislation in the form of criminalizing our action, but also the difficulty to have access to funding, because more and more funding of some important donors are linked to respect of counterterrorism legislation, which of course has an impact on our principal humanitarian action. But we see also more and more the effect of sanction regime, in particular sanction regime whose objective is to countering terrorism. And the combined effect of these three aspects of legislation have clearly directly impacted the IHRC operation. And what we say also to stakeholders, that if we have been impacted with, as IHRC, the other humanitarian organization have been even more impacted than the IHRC, and there is a need to find solution to this situation.
Duncan?
The short answer is yes. When we try to access an area of territory, we're going to refer perhaps to the recent communication by MSF on the impact of counterterrorism legislation in Nigeria. It is not only because of counterterrorism legislation in Nigeria that we cannot access significant parts of the Northeast, but that is clearly an important factor in that lack of access. We have to also look at the other side and the challenges of negotiating with those groups. But absolutely, I mean, and when you have a territory that is largely controlled, especially outside of the urban centers, by, in this case, what is being clearly labeled a terrorist group, and we cannot go into those areas either because of the Nigerian military or because we can simply not contact those groups themselves, it's problematic because we can't reach the majority of the population with the medical care that we have available and would be able to offer.
So they need it.
If the situation on those in the areas where we can actually access is any indicator to the other parts of the province, yes, absolutely needed.
Danny, what should they do? Negotiating, perhaps, with the government says, no, you just can't go there.
Well, you know, if I go back to the Battle of Solferino and Henri Dunant, which was the beginning of the Red Cross, I mean, it was both sides they took care of. There was a distinction between the civilians and the army, but still both sides were looked after. And it seems to me we're in such a politicized atmosphere today that to be neutral, independent, is almost impossible. And as soon as you talk about terrorists, you're already making an ethical decision about who those people are. So immediately people are going to say, why do you talk to them? Why do you help them? You're giving them support. And it's very difficult to overcome that today.
It's really uncomfortable to sort of debate under, not because of what you said, but in that frame, because it's really a misconception of what humanitarian aid intends to do. It's not just about not being political and supporting one side or the other, precepts of neutrality, reciprocity in terms of caring for wounded. It's humanitarian. We're not going to change the shape of a contact. We're applying band-aids. I mean, hopefully very needed band-aids, but that's what we do. And you oblige us to take a political position. We are as at risk as those who are engaging directly in the fighting, and we become a target ourselves. It's a misconception that exaggerates the potential impact. We're there to alleviate human suffering, do our best, sometimes successfully, sometimes we could do a lot better, but we're certainly not going to shape the political future of the conflict and certainly not enter the debate. The humanitarian should be absolutely excluded from that.
Tristan, final word from you.
The final word would be just a call to governments. And we are actually working with international humanitarian actors to make sure that governments will now take mitigating measures in order to really just nuance the effects and the side effects of counterterrorism measures. There is a sufficient number of clearly evidence that we are directly impacted by this. And states start to realize the side effects of their legislation. They need to find with us mitigating measures to help us to carry out the mandates that, once again, they have assigned us to do under the Geneva Conventions.
Daniel Warner, Tristan Ferrero and Duncan McLean, thank you very much for joining us. A lot of food for thought there, and maybe for government leaders looking for maybe short-term headlines about doing something about terrorism. If you're ever caught up in a war zone, you'd probably be very glad to see Duncan or Tristan and not question why they're doing what they're doing.
That was Imogen Folks in Geneva, which is home to the headquarters of about 40 international organizations and 32,000 diplomats and civil servants. Visit us at swissinfo.ch for more stories about them and the work that they do. We produce this podcast every few weeks, so check back soon or follow us on Twitter or Facebook to hear about the next one. Even better, subscribe to The Swiss Connection to be sure that you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and thank you to studio technician Donnie Wheeler. Signing off for all of us here, I'm Susan Masika.